You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Well, hello and welcome to TFM's local watering hole, and I am so excited to be coming at you from, 1776. It is dandy out here right now. It's balmy weather in South Carolina, and I am with my co-host for the week, Rye. Rye, it's so good to have you back, especially for a special film that you've never seen before.
Yeah, happy to be back. It's always fun as usual. But yes, until 2 days ago, I have never seen the film we're talking about today.
That is crazy to me. But I was also showing somebody today who's younger than I am for the first time the cowbell skit from Saturday Night Live. And so I have to be reminded, You know what? I'm pretty old these days, so my whole rest of my life is just going to be about introducing things to people that was too old for them to be able to remember. So anyway, excited to be here. This is going to be a lot of fun. We are doing this film, The Patriot, because, hey, this year it's America 250, and we could have done this, of course, in July, but July will actually have a lot of new releases in it, and so therefore this probably just wouldn't fit into our schedule. And so why not talk about it now, because the whole year is America 250. So That's right, happy birthday, America. But thanks so much for listening. Of course, you could find us all over the place wherever you get your podcasts. You know, if you're on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, a place where you can give a star rating or a review, you know, we would love it if you would do that. It does really help people find the show, and it's one of the best ways to spread a podcast, word of mouth wise. Also, too, another good way is just to share that with your friends. You could find us all over, the social medias where you could share us over, like on X Twitter at the 602 Club. We're on Instagram at the 602 Club TFM. You can also find us online at TFN.fan. You can also find us on Facebook, Facebook.com/TrekFM. So many different places to find us, as well as being able to go over to Patreon to support the network, make sure all this stuff keeps coming to you each and every week at Patreon.com/TrekFM. So, Rye, mentioned that this is your first revolution, but it probably won't be the last. And I wanted to just ask you about kind of coming into this movie. What did you know about it? What were your expectations coming in? And all that kind of stuff, you know, since this is your first time.
Yeah, I mean, I knew very, very little. It's been on the watch list for a while, but simply because it's in the zeitgeist, popular Mel Gibson. I knew Mel Gibson was in it. His face is on the poster. I knew my dad liked it. And I knew it was about America in some sort. So I knew practically nothing about the movie, which was kind of fun going in, being able to just fresh eyes, take it what it is. Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. I mean, it's always kind of fun to come into a movie and not really know what to expect. But you obviously know that it's a movie about the Revolutionary War. It's got Mel Gibson in it. Was there any, because of those two things, even just specifically, and, you know, I know you've seen Braveheart, so did you have then any expectations of what this film could be like then because of that stuff?
This movie came out in 2000, so this is like the pinnacle of like Mel Gibson's height and his popularity. I knew it's a historical epic made in the 2000s or, you know, around the 90s, 2000s. So I knew it would be, you know, there'd be effort put in, like there'd be, it would feel like a real place and feel like a real movie, you know, all these things, which we'll talk about. But, so like, I kind of figured like whether I think this is a masterpiece or like kind of like going into when we watched Master and Commander, mm-hmm. where it was like, this is an early 2000s like epic. Like, there's going to be elements of this that are just going to be embedded in it that I'm going to love, whether I right. connect to the story or whatever. That's a whole nother conversation. But the expectation of the production, the costuming, the Mel Gibson, you know, I was going to love that aspect of it.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I think that's, you know, it's interesting because I remember when this movie came out, you know, it's right in when I was really getting into seeing movies. You know, I'm in college at this point when this comes out, and, you know, I can go see everything that I want. And yeah, I mean, I remember when this one came out, you know, especially after having watched Braveheart and just being very excited about the prospect of doing this, you know, and one of my favorite subjects has always been the Revolutionary War anyway. And so the fact that we were going to get, you know, in that sense, like a Braveheart style film about something that I was also very interested in and excited to see put to life on screen. I was definitely looking forward to that. And so, well, you know, we've mentioned a couple of times this movie has Mel Gibson in it. He's the star. Mm-hmm. And at that time, especially, he is the main draw for the movie. But I wanted to ask you about this before we even just talk about Mel and his performance and all, but because he's such a pivotal part of the film, they originally asked Harrison Ford to be the lead of Benjamin Martin. And he turned this down because he considered it to be too violent. And he thought it boiled the Revolutionary War down to one guy wanting revenge. So I guess first, you know, as we talk about the idea of the fact that the role went to Mel, could you even imagine like Harrison Ford doing this and having like a ponytail possibly? And like, does that work in your, does that compute in your mind?
I mean, it computes in the sense that, like, he's Harrison Ford and he's like an all time great. So I'm sure he could like pull off whatever he does. But aside from that, I'd say like, no, I don't, he doesn't exactly fit the bill for like what this character is, or even the type of movie that it is. Someone like Mel Gibson is, you know, the perfect insert for that. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised that he was offered the role. I mean, this was 2000. Like, this is, I mean, post Star Wars, Indiana Jones. Like, this is, he's the guy right now.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's not, I'm glad it's not him. I'll say that.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's just a really interesting prospect, the idea of Harrison Ford, because, you know, I love Harrison Ford. You know, My wife and I have enjoyed him, you know, especially even recently in things he's done. Like, he's been fantastic and was fantastic in the show 1923. Mm-hmm. I don't know why he had never been in more Westerns, because he's actually pretty perfect for them.
He was really great for that.
I mean, just so good. And then we've been watching him in Shrinking, where he's just hysterical, and he's actually a really funny comedic person, and that's I think specifically because it plays against kind of his type, and so when you get that, it's just hysterical in that way.
Yeah.
And so I love that, and I think he is really, really great. But I think that in that sense that I'm with you, I think he could do this. But I think even just visually, kind of seeing him be in this role, it's like, it just feels weird to think of like Harrison Ford, you know, basically having long hair, you know, the way all the men kind of do in this film and at that time period. And so I think, again, I know Harrison, and I know he could do it in that sense. You know, I mean, we're not like friends or anything, but you know, I know
you know him. I'd love to meet him.
Yeah, that would be awesome if I actually did, right? But you know, I could absolutely, I know he could pull it off. Mm-hmm. Was he the right guy to pull it off? I don't think so. I think we picked the right person for the role, and that being Mel Gibson. So I wanted to ask you is you know, we've been, you know, talking about the fact that, you know, he is the lead and really the guy that kind of makes this movie happen, I think, in a lot of ways, just because mm-hmm. he's in it and he's the big draw. What did you think about his performance and really what he brings to the role here as this main character of Benjamin Martin?
Yeah, I mean, I thought he was great. I think, like many things that he's in, I'm just a fan of all. I mean, Braveheart. I really love Signs. It's the rare like M. Night movie that I love, and I think he always brings this like seriousness to a role, believability that he like if you know some larger than life actors. We'll go into a movie and you can't help but just see, oh, that's this person, which is always the fear with someone like a Mel Gibson that's just so big, so larger than life. But going into this, watching him, I was like, man, he gets it. He blends right in. It's not like I'm watching. I don't feel like I'm watching Mel Gibson. I'm watching, you know, Benjamin Martin and his story and, you know, the things that he's dealing with, the, you know, his sins, the traumas, the revenge, the stuff with his family, like all this stuff that he's going through war, is really believable. And it's because Mel Gibson's so good in the role, versus if you get a guy that's just kind of phoning it in or is not chameleoning, if that's even a word, himself into that space, then I can probably take you out of it. But because I just felt like I was watching this unfold with just the character, not the actor, it made it really great. And he's really great.
Yeah, I think that that's kind of one of the most interesting things about him as an actor. And I think a big part of this is, you know, when I think of Braveheart and I think of this, you know, the characters have a lot of similarities in many ways. But I think one of the things that that Mel Gibson brings to his acting is that in every role that he's in, he just feels incredibly human.
That's a really good point.
And so, you know, whether you're watching him in Lethal Weapon or you're watching him in something like Signs or you're watching him in one of his big action roles, you know, historical epics like this or Braveheart or just like anything he's done, he just comes off as a great. In fact, I think of, you know, in the last few years, you know, he did the movie Fat Man where he plays Santa. You know, yeah, which is just a phenomenal film. And really? He is so good in the role as this kind of down and out Santa in many ways, who is trying to deal with the modern world and everything and keep this thing afloat and has a hitman coming after him. I mean, yeah, it's just it's great in that sense. And I think as you watch this movie specifically, you just become acutely aware of the way in which Mel Gibson doesn't even have to speak. It's written all over his face exactly what he's feeling, exactly what the character is going through. I mean, that moment where, you know, the big moments, you think of like when both of his sons die, both of them basically in his arms. You think of, you know, when his daughter, Susan, his youngest, who has been traumatized so much, she hasn't been speaking. And the moment she finally speaks, it breaks him, right? You know, like, and it's all over his face. He's not even saying anything. It just is there. And you feel every single ounce of emotion that the character is feeling. And that is the ineffable quality that Mel Gibson has as an actor to make you believe and feel and experience what he is going through as that character. And again, I just think it really comes down to being such a human quality.
Yeah, you can see like all of the underlying things going on, and not everything's having to be said. You know, he has scenes where he's, you know, passionate, you know, the typical, you know, actor scenes where it's like, man, this guy's good. And it's just guy yelling in the camera.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is always, they are good, of course. But like, there's like this, there's the quiet, there's, you know, the quietness, the guilt, the every emotion he's feeling, whether they're big emotions outward or they're reserved within. You see them all very apparently. And that's obviously the mark of a great actor, is when you can communicate how you're wanting the audience to be reacting as well with the character, without the script saying it and without like an outward, like whatever, crazy blow up. So I think I agree with you. It's, it's impressive stuff.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many. Just even kind of fun moments too, you know. I think of, you know, when he's making the boys wait for him to open the mail, right? And he knows exactly what they want because they're sitting there waiting to go to bed, you know, and just kind of like doodling around, you know, waiting for dad to open the mail. And he's basically just giving them a hard time about it. Like, I'm going to take my sweet time. And it just, again, all of these little moments just add up to creating a character who feels like somebody that you would meet that could be a next door neighbor or, you know, if you lived in 1776, I guess, you know. And so I think that that's wonderful. And the crazy thing about that is, though, as well, is that the performance is not that different from other performances he gives, right? But it all kind of feels like variation on a theme, but it never feels removed from what he's in. Like, I never feel like that this is just Mel Gibson being Mel Gibson, but it is Mel Gibson bringing all of his actorly talent to the role to bring this out. And many of the things that he does are be things that he does in other films. But again, there's just a humanity to it. And we keep saying this, but like, I watch this film and I'm just really impressed with an actor who can draw me in that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that he is kind, I wouldn't say he's singular, but there are very few people who are, I think, this good at the craft of acting and make it look so effortless and at the same time make it look impossible, if that makes sense.
It does. I think that you mentioned something that's important to he's giving Mel Gibson, he's doing his thing, but there's a big difference in utilizing an actor and what they're good at versus like he's just like playing himself again. Like, The Rock, until The Smashing Machine, just did The Rock. Ryan Reynolds, a lot of times, is just doing Ryan Reynolds. And whether that's bad or good, that's for the viewer to interpret that. But they are simply being just them. Versus this, where he's doing Mel Gibson, but it's like, he's just elevating and doing what he's best at. It doesn't feel like a gimmick, where those other actors can sometimes feel like that. So that's a great point you made.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think one of the most interesting aspects of this film for me is the way in which the movie is kind of really this meditation on the atrocities of war that can, you know, a soldier can be a part of, an instigator of, or even just be a victim of, and then having to live with them. In some ways too, like, how do you not become a monster permanently from that? Because the whole movie just begins with a quote he'll actually say later too. And it's a quote that I think is incredibly beautiful because, and it's haunting because I think all of us have experienced this idea. And, you know, he says, "I've long feared my sins would return to visit me, and the cost is more than I can bear." And that is an incredibly powerful statement for us as humans that I think all of us intrinsically, when we hear that, there are those things to which we're like, man, if I have to pay for the consequence of this fully, I can't. It's going to be terrible.
Yeah, 100%. Like it, those things, like the quote captures something so weighty about life, whether like Christian or not. Like, obviously we're in the space where like this is something we talk about quite a bit because the Bible speaks pretty clearly about these things. And so, but for everybody, it's like, man, there's things that I've done, there's wrongs that I've done that if I have to deal with them again, if I have to open up the possibility of dealing with them again, if I have to face them again, like that is not like an easy thing for anybody because of the recognition that, man, I messed up and I just want it to be in the past. And that's kind of what we see Benjamin confronting this entire movie, is like that his sins are coming back to haunt him. They're right here. Is he going to be the same monster that he was? Like, all this is still pressing on. And I think even opening with the quote is obviously very smart filmmaking and setting up the whole narrative and what we're going to be dealing with the character. But yeah, it's the idea of sin coming back and becoming who you once were, being this crux of what everything Benjamin's feeling and worried about throughout the whole movie, is really effective in drawing the viewer and drawing me in to be like, I can relate to this, even though I was never in the Revolutionary War, you know, like I've never been in a war, but I can relate to this feeling what this guy is going through. That's really good filmmaking.
Yeah, you weren't. That wasn't your past life was a Revolutionary War fighter. I think I like the way that you say that, because the other part about this, and even just the very tangible part in the sense for the film of a character who is famous for revenge against an enemy in a way that leaves no doubt that they've been conquered, right? And it's brutal and horrible, and it's something to which he has come to not just regret, but wish had never happened in many ways. And that is interesting because, you know, I think that this becomes then a juxtaposition between him and our, you know, bad guy and Tavington, right? They are mirrors for one another. And I think that's the thing about this that so many critics, I think, kind of missed when this movie came out, when they were complaining about the war atrocities that were being, you know, committed here, and did that really happen in reality and all this kind of stuff, right? That's not what this is about. This is a thematic element that's being played out between these two characters. And what it is you have Martin's character, who is one who is working for penance for the sin he committed, right? And you have another who's wholly committed to his terrible actions and has absolutely no remorse. And so you have a moral character then who is struggling with the immorality of some of his actions to the point where he knows how immoral they were, and that, again, if he has to pay for those consequences, there is nothing he can do to bear them. And then you have another character who could care less about whether something is moral or not. He truly is somebody who is legitimately out for only number one. He doesn't even care about the war, really. It's really just about his own advancement, who he's going to be, you know, when the, you know, British win the war, what land he can get for himself. And I think that's the thing that I just feel like so many people kind of miss. This isn't about necessarily, and we'll talk about it a little bit later with historical accuracy and stuff, but that's not what this is about. This truly is a juxtaposition between two worldviews and between two ways of living. And the point is, by kind of bringing it to the extreme with Tavington, we get a chance to see what Benjamin Martin could have been if he had mm-hmm. never turned around, if he had never seen the error of his ways, he had never seen the evilness of his previous ways, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's really smart pairing these two against each other, because you obviously get the, this guy's evil, he's bad, he's prideful, he's arrogant, he wants himself, he wants him. Very easy guy to root against. But then you got Martin, who, you know, is dealing with tension, is dealing with, you know, the weight of his sin, and that's the morality behind him opposed to the guy who has no morality makes for an interesting mashing and tension between two characters. And then you have obviously Mel Gibson playing Martin, and then but Jason Isaacs, who is so good as well in this role. So I think everything you said is correct. I think it's not about the accuracy of what's going on here, but the thematic elements of these two characters and what they're trying to say about Martin's character specifically, which, like we've been saying, continues to be relatable to the viewer, at least sounds like both of us. So
yeah, no, I think it's one of those places where the movie is basically, you know, everything is trying to give you some sort of message.
Mm-hmm.
And I truly believe that this movie is asking you to ask the question, which one of these is better? And, you know, I really think that the fundamental question at the end of the film then between these two characters really is, you know, one of these characters is truly cares about nobody but himself, and the other one cares about everybody but himself, right? And that's what we mm-hmm. come to see, right? We, you know, Martin was a young hothead person during the French and Indian War, and he took that out on the French there at mm-hmm. that fort in a way that was evil and wrong, and he has lived with that now. And so his every move since that point of coming to that realization has been to be a man who is selfless. He has a family. Mm-hmm. He takes care of them. You know, he takes care of those under his employ. And he's looking to also take care of, you know, the larger context as well and his responsibility there. And so I just find that to be an incredibly fascinating thing, because it does come down to the question then, in our world, do we want more people to look like Benjamin Martin, or do we want people to look mm-hmm. like Tavington? And when we see the picture of Tavington and just how bad it is, right, you know, the automatic answer for everyone is like, oh, no, nobody's like that. But left to our own devices and our own cares of only ourselves, that's who we slowly turn into.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't.
You know, we might not be shooting kids, you know, but
totally.
That doesn't mean it's still not terrible.
The point isn't like, are you going to do everything that Tavington does, like on a like a? But the point is like what underlies and still how you are treating people. Like Tavington, actions are driven by he's cruel, he's prideful, his ambition, his. He wants supremacy. He instills right. fear yeah, into yeah. people. He belittles. Like he does it as like he uses like violence as a weapon, but also he's using violence as like, you know, like it's just like good. He just enjoys it. And so it's like, yeah, no one, we're not necessarily, I mean, we're not talking about on an everyday level of like the everyday man literally shooting people and right. being a war criminal, but we are talking about like a moral like tension between left to our own devices. Like you said, we are that personal like selfishness. We want our own ambition. We want to reign supreme. We want to be above people and do whatever it takes to get there versus a Martin character who is, because he's experienced what that is like, because he knows what it is like to be this monster, he then, you know, turns around and says, I am going to be selfless. I'm going to only use violence out of protection and responsibility for my family. I'm going to enter the war because it's the last result. I'm only going to do this, this, and this because I'm trying to do what's best for someone else and not myself. I mean, it's the whole picture of the best way to live is to live, you know, for others and not yourself. And, you know, you could quote a bajillion different things to prove that. But
well, and I think on top of that, right, you know, that way of living that Tavington has, right, is everybody is just seen as a stepping stone. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone is a commodity to be used to get what you want. Whereas, yeah, you know, for Martin, right, as we see him here and his more matured state, his life is lived in service of others, right? His family, those around him. And then, of course, the greater representation of this birth of a new nation. And so, mm-hmm, and that leads to a really important question that the movie also asks and has to deal with, especially through the character of Martin. You know, you think of in Ecclesiastes a time for war and a time for peace. Mm-hmm. This movie is really about knowing the difference between these two. And I found that to be incredibly interesting because at first, you know, we have Martin here because of his previous experience finding himself a little bit too wrapped up in the idea of there is never a reason really to go to war anymore. We don't. Mm-hmm. And so the question about like, when do we go to war? When do we not go to war? Really plays out in this character. And of course, you know, he doesn't make that leap until his inaction, his passivity in many ways, causes the death of one of his sons.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's really interesting because there's a lot that's being said there about, you know, what it means to be a man who is actively working to protect and keep the people around him, you know, the protection that, you know, we have as men for everything around us, you know, our families, mm-hmm, our society in general. It's huge what this movie is actually talking about.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting topic that's not at all controversial or
not at all.
I think it's good when movies are dealing with these questions. And it does, you know, pose something where with specifically the scene with his son, his first son dying, where, yeah, his passivity, his like commitment to peace actually only harmed someone. Like, his son died because of his, you know, commitment to staying back and saying, oh no, I don't want to get involved. I don't want war. I don't want this. I don't want that. And so I think it does a really good job because it makes it like, really, I don't know if practical is the right word, but like makes you feel it like on a personal level. Like if this is you in this scenario, what are you doing? Is this just, is war just here? Should we go to war? Should we stay peaceful? What should we do? And I think painting it in this light, while still simply posing the question, is really effective. And it obviously makes you think like, well, what would you do in that scenario? Are you fighting back? Are you staying peaceful and letting your son die? Obviously, you don't exactly know that that's going to happen, but and then like when you do choose to fight, I think it poses the question like, how do you, with just the character itself, it poses the question like, how do you enter into war while keeping humanity and justice and without, you know, creeping into that Tavington realm. It's asking a lot of really interesting questions about a, you know, just a seemingly could be a cookie cutter historical epic.
Yeah, I like that, the way that you were framing that, because, you know, there are a lot of different questions here, just to kind of dealing with the authority and the misuse of authority and what authority mm-hmm. has been given. You know, do these colonists and their representatives then and their elected government have the right to do this, you know, and is that right been given to them because of the misuse of authority by the king that he has been given, you know, and then what is the authority then that, you know, Benjamin Martin himself has in the sense of his use of force to keep his family safe, you know? All of these questions, I think, are incredibly deep questions that get asked by the film. And I love that moment in the movie where he confesses, you know, I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed for having done nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And because he knows what that nothing cost him.
Yeah.
You know, it does kind of make us wonder if he had taken action earlier, you know, would the consequences of all of these things, like the death of his son, Thomas happened, the death of his son, Gabriel, could that have possibly mm-hmm. been averted if, you know, he had been more proactive and been less passive and more protective, as he should have been this whole time, and not just for himself, but for, you know, he is somebody who has a vote and a voice, and the mm-hmm. way that he utilizes that voice is interesting, because, you know, the measure passes without him to go to war for South mm-hmm. Carolina to join with the rest of the colonies. But again, yes, his passivity and not choosing to go to war himself, keeping his family at home in a place that's turning into a war zone, is just really interesting. And I love that there really are no easy answers, in the sense that for the character, yes, his choices do have massive consequences. And those consequences are things then that we have to learn to live with.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's interesting because it's like which path he views it as, one path or the other, obviously, where it's like he felt guilt and shame from what he did in his past, and now he feels guilt and shame for what he did in the present. One was with violence, one with his passivity. There's got to be a middle somewhere. Or if you're going to feel guilty, would you rather feel guilty in protecting someone you love and, you know, doing harm towards someone that's evil? Like, that's the question.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Couldn't agree more. Let's talk a little bit about some of the cast. One, obviously, mm-hmm. we've talked about Jason Isaacs playing Colonel William Tavington. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's kind of heavily fictionized version of a character who existed, and again, heavily fictionalized. So like Mel Gibson, they had actually offered the role to Jude Law and asked him to play the role, but they went with Isaacs when they saw his audition tape. And so I guess a question that I do have for you is, do you think Jude Law would have been a good choice?
That's an interesting question. Jude Law. I think I could see it. I haven't seen a lot of Jude Law movies, but I'm like looking at a photo of him, like, could I see him in this role? Like, I could, like, he's great in a lot of things. He's really fantastic in a movie that came out 2 years ago called The Order, which is incredible. But I don't know if I see him in it, just because I don't know. I have not seen a ton of him in that type of role before. So I don't even know if I could properly answer that. Like similar answer to like Harrison Ford, like Jude Law is a great actor. So I think he could probably pull it off. I think more than Harrison Ford could pull off Benjamin Martin.
Yeah.
But Jason Isaacs is so good that it's like, I can't really see anybody else doing it.
Yeah.
How do you feel?
This is definitely a spot where I could see Jude Law doing this. I think he would have been great in the role. I don't think there would have been any issue with it. I don't actually have really a question of like, oh, could he do it? But Jason Isaacs is one of those people who has the ability to make you hate that character so much.
Mm-hmm.
Every little mannerism, the way in which he delivers lines, the absolute authority with which he has taken upon himself to speak, the utter disdain that he has for every single other character that he's speaking to. Doesn't matter who they are, even if, you know, he's speaking to his superior, right? He is just, yes, I think that in many ways he's just so perfect for this role, and he plays it phenomenally. Like he does.
He has the feel and the look that feels far more evil and slimy, and like Jude Law's great,
but
like he just feels like the feel of Jason Isaacs in this doesn't feel like it could be replicated by someone else.
Yeah, the word that comes to mind is swarmy. Like he just is slimy and ugh, you know, like all you can think of is like, ugh, you know, you can think of is like these just utterances, not actual words to describe how like icky he is as a character. Right. And it's just great. No, and so, true. No, I think he's phenomenal. You mentioned to me the other day, you dropped by my office and you're like, man, I didn't realize that Heath Ledger is in this movie. I miss him so much. And yes, I do too, because goodness, he is so great in this film. And I think one of the things that makes him good is that when you can go toe-to-toe with Mel Gibson at his height of acting prowess, and you don't feel as though that character is cowering or fearful in any way, but at the same time, the way he plays it as an utterly respectful son, but also with the conviction that no, what I'm doing is right and what you're doing is wrong. And you know, the fact that, you know, Gibson's Martin comes around to that fact later on. Heath Ledger is just fantastic in this film.
Yeah, he's so, I mean, like, he's so good. And obviously heartbreaking. Just his unexpected passing after The Dark Knight. He doesn't have the biggest filmography where, you know, but when he's in the roles where he's not, you know, wearing all this makeup and playing the legitimately one of the most evil characters in fiction, he's so charming and so believable in every role. And you watch him, you're like, man, I like you. I can get behind you. You're a special actor. The believability of it, like you said, like he's going toe to toe with Mel Gibson. And I mean, he's like, gosh, 30 or something like this in this role. No, I can't do math. He's born 79.
He's
21.
Yeah, I was about to say he's my age.
He's 21.
He would have been my 20, age. That's because
21 years old in this movie. Like he's, and then to go 10 Things I Hate About You, The Patriot,
10 Things I Hate About
A Knight's Tale.
Yes.
Just back to, I mean, 2001.
It's fantastic.
That's a crazy run as someone that is 20, 21, and 22 years old.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think it's like he's everything that I've seen him in. He's just captures the role perfectly. He does exactly what you need him to do. There's not much that hasn't been said about him. Obviously, he's just missed, man. It's sad that we can't to this day be seeing more Heath Ledger roles.
Yeah, I agree. So, you know, I think the other thing about this film is it's just full of great performances across the board for everyone.
It's got a great cast.
You know, it's a fantastic cast. Like Rene Auberjonois, who shows up, you know, who is, you know, very famous for his role in Star Trek Deep Space Nine is Odo. He's just awesome. Chris Cooper showing up in this role. Tom Wilkinson, Donald Logue, Adam Baldwin. I mean, there's just all of these people that would go on to be seen in so many things. And I love that because they all kind of fit the roles that they play incredibly well. Mm-hmm. And none of them take away in any way from the roles that they're playing. So it's great in totally. That sense. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you had mentioned, like right at the very beginning when we were talking about you coming into this, and you talked about the idea of like, this is a movie that is made in 2000, you know, or a little bit before, and it came out in 2000. And so you knew, you felt like the production was going to be top notch. And like Braveheart, you know, this is a big historical epic. This movie is actually filmed all in South Carolina. And so I just wanted to ask you about how you felt like they brought the world of, you know, 1776 and the war in South Carolina to life.
Yeah, I mean, kind of perfectly. It's something with like with the production design, with the costume design, where they shot it, it all feels so like this real place that feels lived in, that feels, you know, it doesn't feel like they're on a set of a movie in a studio backlot, which is a lot of what we get today. I thought they did a great job just making it, feel like a real place. And that's a huge thing for movies like this, because if it doesn't feel believable that like we're really in South Carolina, then, you know, the movie can still be good, but it's like, man, it'd be way cooler if this felt like a real movie. Yeah. And so I think doing something like that is just huge. It feels like, I mean, I was looking up before this, like movies that feel like this, and it's like Braveheart, Saving Private Ryan, Gladiator, 300, like Troy, even a little bit, like all these kind of 80s to 2000s, you know, big blockbusters that they do a great, like, the production is so good, and the reason the movie's so good, or at least what adds to it, is that they take the time to like pay extra money to film in South Carolina versus just filming and at the Warner Brothers lot or wherever, know? So it always enhances a movie experience for me when something as big as this feels big.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I think the beauty of this film is it just looks and feels real.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it feels visceral, you know. You know, the fight scenes that they have, too, are not the same, obviously, as you get in, like, a Braveheart. But there are some incredibly, I think, real shots when you see a guy get his leg taken off by a cannonball, and you see people, you know, getting shot with the musket balls at that time, or sliced with a sword, and all that kind of stuff. It just feels very real. But just the size of the production, and I think the reality of being in those locations, and even when they utilize there are not a ton of times where you feel like, oh, I know that is a CGI shot. You know, when they do that thing where they go by the wharf and they've got all the ships there and everything, you know that's CGI. Like, because there are not that many wooden vessels like that anymore, the same way they were back then.
Totally.
You know, the shot, the establishing shot of them going towards Charleston, you know that is a CGI shot as well, but none of them feel so blatant or anything like that. that you're pulled mm-hmm. out of the scenes. And I think that's just something that's incredibly powerful in a film like this. And then again, just the production value of them being in a house there in South Carolina with fields and everything, and everything just, if you've been to South Carolina, you're like, oh yeah, this is what it's like. And there's just mm-hmm. something about that that you can't put your finger on, but it's really well done. And so, scores can be incredibly powerful, especially scores done by John Williams. And the score here is done by the great John Williams. And so I wanted to ask you, you know, obviously his repertoire of scores is just beyond comparison. But so really, in the end, the only one you compare Williams to is Williams. And so how did you mm-hmm. feel like he did here with the score for The Patriot?
Great. It's kind of hard to, it's like every movie that it's like the John Williams scored it. It's like, this is going to add to the movie. And so it can feel like a, I can feel like a broken record anytime I talk about John Williams, cause he's the best for a reason, or one of the, you know, arguably the best. There's a couple guys coming up, guys like Hans Zimmer, and then some newer guys that are, if they keep at it, they'll be up there with him. But like, he's has a proven track record of like every movie that he scores, the movie could be bad. The movie could be like legitimately not good. And it's like, but man, that score was great. It elevated the movie a whole. He's the only composer I know that like legitimately elevates movies, like scores from like if out of five, it's like, yeah, this is a three, it would be a 1.5. But man, John Williams is just so good that I can't give this movie any lower. You know, so I think that's no different here. I think the score is really great. I think it elevates the emotional kind of aspects of the movie. It's not one note. It's very like, there's different sounds throughout. It's not, you know, there's the epic, you know, moments, but there's quiet moments. He's the best.
Yeah.
And I love him.
Yeah. It's kind of hard not to, you know, it's very interesting because I mean, my first CD was the Jurassic Park soundtrack. And you know,
just so perfect.
It's great, right? His work is bar none, just incredible. And mm-hmm. so I think that the thing that I was thinking about with this score is that, you know, for Williams, this score is pretty understated. And a little bit more muted than you might expect, but I think it is it's a good score and it really fits the film. I really like the way in which, you know, it works with the rest of the movie. I think he does an excellent job, as, you know, he is wont to do, as being a complete master. And so,
yeah, it fits the themes really well. Like it does, like there's movies where, you know, scores feel phoned in. Like here's basic score one war movie. Yep. Here you go. But this movie has a lot, as we've been talking about for, you know, close to an hour. It's like this is not just like war movies, shoot guns and cannons and kill people. Like there's a lot of depth here. And I think his score reflects that. It reflects the home family feel. It reflects the tensions of war and peace and our characters. Like it's you can tell that he puts effort into these things when he probably could just do it in his sleep and it'd still be good, but it elevates it. And it's like, man, this is memorable because he's so intentional.
I could not agree more. We talked about, you know, the way in which, you know, this movie, has so much to it. And especially the fact that we're going to have these big battle scenes. And so I wanted to ask you, what you thought of the battle scenes then in this movie?
thought they were great. I mean, I feel like a broken record. You can kind of tell that I like the movie. But the battle scenes are, I mean, they're realistic. Yeah, yeah. They feel realistic. They feel chaotic and gritty, and like there's emotional stakes in every, like, it's not just like mindless battle. Yeah. It feels like there's a real weight to these scenes with like personal consequences, not just like, there's like obviously national consequences because it's like a war between countries, but it feels like there's real personal stuff going on here, obviously with like Gabriel's death and like obviously everything we deal with Mel Gibson's character. So I think they're brutal, like you said. I think they feel real. I think they're sad. Kind of everything you want in something like this. How'd you feel about them?
Yeah, I think it's top notch. You know, I think just the work that's done here to make it feel very realistic in a way that, you know, isn't overly gruesome or anything. But, you know, you do, I think, want the opportunity to feel this, right? You want the opportunity to feel like you're there and what it was like. And I think it's a hallmark of the film to be able to do that. You know, what I find to be an interesting thing is that this movie is directed by Roland Emmerich, you know, for Godzilla, the 19...
Interesting filmography. Yeah,
exactly.
Man. That guy's got...
Independence Day, Day After Tomorrow.
He's got some stinkers, yeah,
some real
though.
Bad films, right? and yet this, I think, works on levels that a lot of those other movies just don't, for, I think, lots of reasons. And this one, I think it's because of the cast. I think it's because of the script. I think it's because of just a lot of things that don't work in those other movies. Even just the idea of the films that, you know. Mm-hmm. This is good, and the battle scenes are a big part of that. And so we touched a little bit on this just previously, but, you know, a lot has been made about the fact that, yes, this is not a completely historically accurate film. And so I wanted to ask you, you know, how you felt about that and, you know, whether or not when it comes to historical movies, historical epics, Are you ever going into a film just expecting it to be, you know, completely historically accurate? Or are you always expecting some sort of embellishment or fictionalization of whatever it is?
I mean, there's things in, like, let's, you know, any historical movie, whether it's an epic or a biopic, they're like, you should probably get right. Like, you got to have the basic skeletons of who this person is, what this story is, especially depending on what your goal is. But like something like this, where it's like they're telling a broad thing, broad story, but very, very, very specific story about two characters, specifically Mel Gibson's. Like, I don't care. Like, it's okay with me. I don't ever need something like this. Like, it's a movie. Like, I'll just say that. Yeah. Like, it's going to be embellished. If you have a problem with that, I think that's fine. But, like, don't – I don't like when people, like, it's not historically accurate, so you can't enjoy it. It's like, man, I'm still going to enjoy it because I don't need every movie to be historically accurate in every sense because it's a movie. If I want to learn – strictly about the Revolutionary War and everything that went on with it, I'd watch a documentary or I'd read a book. And that's just kind of how I feel, because movies are, yes, teach you things and, you know, are deeper than just pure entertainment, but they are entertainment. It's a form to have fun with and enjoy and play around with. Like, it's a form of art that they don't have to keep everything accurate. It's the same thing with what people are talking about with Nolan's The Odyssey. I don't care. I'm here to watch a good movie, and if the movie's great, then I'm not gonna See, if the movie sucks, I might nitpick it a little bit more, but I enjoy the movie. It's fun. It's got things that what it adds is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think, no, I like what you're saying in that sense. Like I would never go into a film like this and expect that it has to be completely historically accurate, that you're not going to take some license. And basically I think what we talked about earlier, right? Look, that the story is pointing at these thematic elements that is incredibly important. And therefore the things that they're doing in the movie are about building towards that. They're not as worried about the historical accuracy of the film. You know, there are a lot of places where they're trying to be historically accurate, but then there's other places where they're not. And I think, you know, going into any film like that and understanding that is just important. You know, I would say, you know, for me, there's, you know, a big difference between like being kind of blatantly and brazenly inaccurate on purpose, it seems like.
That's
you fair. Know, which I might argue that something along the lines of, depending on some of the choices they could make in like the Odyssey, it's like, I think you're doing that on purpose for not necessarily a really good reason. And so, and then there are places where, you know, people are, you know, and so I think that is really just where I would come down on that. So, you know, in the end, I think this is a good movie that it's a movie. And the movie is getting across its point in the and I think the character stories it's wanting to tell, and it's utilizing those character stories and thematic elements to coincide with one another and work in symbiosis to create the overall package that is being presented to us, right? And that, you know, any good movie, that's what you're trying to do. You want the character stories and the thematic elements and just the production value and all this stuff to work together to bring all that to life. And I think they've done a great job in that. So I've got to ask you, yeah, I'm really excited to get to this point where we rate the film, because I am kind of a little bit on pins and needles as to what you're going to rate The Patriot.
Yeah, I intentionally didn't rate it on Letterboxd.
I saw that, you scallywag.
Because I thought about it, but I was like, you know what? I'll wait for this moment. Because I hadn't seen it, so you have no idea what I think. I obviously like the movie a lot. I think it's very good. I love these performances, and so I'll land at a nice, healthy 4 out of 5, 8 out of 10, however you want to put it. Whereas it's a good movie, I'll probably watch it. I enjoyed it a lot. Not perfect by any means. You mentioned that you love like the Revolutionary War. I'm not like passionate about, you know, anything like this, but I love a war movie, and I love, I mean, I like it even more based on our conversation. So definitely 4-star.
Dude, that's awesome, man. I absolutely love hearing that, because I am at a 4-star as well with this. I think it is one of those, you know, just a great film. I have such a good time watching it. I really enjoy this movie, and a big part of that really does come down to the performance that we get with Mel Gibson and just everybody else involved. And I always like going back to this film. It's just one of those where you get to it and you pop it in, and before you know, you're just completely sucked into the story. And before you know it, all you can think about is that moment when Jason Isaacs is going to die, because he's, you know, he's so good at making you hate him. But yeah, I'm so glad we got a chance to do this, and hopefully everybody will enjoy the conversation here. Let us know what you think, of course, all over social media. But Rye, if people did wanted to catch up with you, let people know where they could find you.
Yeah, two places. One would be my Instagram that I talk about film on, Rye Talks About, is the handle, and then I'm over on Letterboxd where I'm really talking a lot about all the movies that I watch. 182nd, O-N-E-82-N-D.
Nice. And you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. Of course, here on the network, outside the 602 Club, lots of great Star Trek talk with Chris Jones. As we do talk about all of the things that we love in the Star Trek universe, so you can find those over on the Nerd Party Network. You'll find me as well with a couple shows. One is called Owl Post, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series. And then you can find me on Aggressive Negotiations as John Mills and I talk about Star Wars each and every week. But thank you so much for joining us. And y'all come back now, you're here.